Lecture 13. Today we will, for last time, go deep into the framework of quantum field theory in curved space, and then next time, on Thursday, we will start applying that. But today it's still formalism. So remember, the free Klein-Gordon quantum field theory consists of these equations here. We have to solve the equation that says that the field is taking values in self-adjoint operators. This is the operator version of what for a classical field would be realness, and the same applies to the canonically conjugate momentum field. Then the acronym for that is HC for hermeticity condition. Then we also have the equations of motion, here written in the Hamiltonian form, Heisenberg equations of motion. Acronym EOM for equations of motion, and the equations of motion for the Klein-Gordon field in particular are those. Here you have the Klein-Gordon equation, and that's the relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum and the field. In order to find out what exactly that relationship is, we had to go all this detour doing the Legendre transform to the action, and then having the whole thing covariant, putting it on curved space, and then Legendre transforming back to the Hamiltonian formulation. This is how we found out what the canonically conjugate momentum field is to phi. Well, and that's not all. Not only do we need the field to be self-adjoint and obeying the equations of motion, but also the commutation relations need to hold, and that will concern us today. More precisely, we must have that on all space-like hypersurfaces sigma, the canonical commutation relations must hold. So we must have equal time commutation relations such that the phi field commute with each other at equal time, the pi's commute with each other at equal time, but arbitrary space. And then the phi pi commutation relations are like that. This is a non-trivial business because if we choose one coordinate system, then we have one particular notion of what means equal time. If we have a generic curved space-time and we have some coordinate system for it, then if we pick a time, a fixed time, then we can look at all those events that have that fixed time. That gives us a space-like hypersurface of space-time. And on that space-like hypersurface, we want the canonical commutation relations to hold. Now, if we choose another coordinate system, then a fixed time, at a fixed time, you have a different set of events in general. You have a different slicing of space-time into a stack of space-like hypersurfaces. When we quantize, the quantization condition, the imposition of the canonical commutation relations, should not remember what slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces we used to do the quantization. So we'll have to convince ourselves that this is possible. All of this is slightly non-trivial because in the Hamiltonian formalism, covariance is not obvious. So we want to show the following, and we started with that at the in the last lecture. We want to show that all those conditions of the previous page, hermeticity condition, equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relations, can be fulfilled for a free Klein-Gordon field theory on curved space-time with this ansatz. This ansatz will succeed, at least if the space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic. Now, globally hyperbolic means that there are Cauchy surfaces, that there are space-like hypersurfaces, such that if you give initial conditions there, you can calculate the complete evolution later on. Or physically speaking, there are no closed time-like curves. You cannot travel to the past. In principle, general relativity allows that, allows for manifolds that have that property, but we will disallow it for the moment. We will look at globally hyperbolic spacetimes, and for those, we want to show that we can solve the Klein-Gordon equation with this ansatz. Now remember how that ansatz is structured. So it's an ansatz for the field phi. And once we have phi, we get pi as well. From well, you see, we had this equation here that related the that expressed the canonically conjugate momentum field in terms of phi. So once we have phi, we have pi as well. Okay, so the ansatz is that phi can be written in this way, where we don't know yet what the u, k of x and t are going to be. But we do know that the a and a dagger operators, we choose to be the usual a and a dagger operators as they act on Hilbert spaces. So these are non-commutative operators obeying that the commutation relations between them are just those. And we will still have to determine what those functions uk are. The ansatz is motivated in two ways. First of all, something very similar already worked. Namely, on Minkowski space, if you remember, we were able to solve the Klein-Gordon equation. And we were able to write it in this way, where the sum over k was really the sum over momenta. And these were factors of the type e to the power of minus I omega t plus kx. And the a and a dagger operators were as usual. So the idea is, we know it worked on Minkowski space. Let's see if we can get away with this ansatz also on curved space, where we stick to those a and a dagger operators, but we allow these functions to be adapted to the curvature of the space-time. And we are agnostic about what the k-index might mean. Last time we already established that this ansatz will succeed in fulfilling at least some of the conditions that we listed on the last page. For example, we showed already that the hermeticity condition is fine. It's going to be obeyed just by the way this is constructed. Take the Hermitian conjugate of this thing and you will find out that no matter what the functions uk are, the dagger of phi is phi, so that's okay. We also showed that the equations of motion will hold under one condition. Namely, as long as each of those functions uk is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, is a number-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then phi is an operator-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. That's because if u is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then u star is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, because the Klein-Gordon equation has only real coefficients. And if these two functions are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, then multiplying them with a constant, yes, it's an operator, but it's a constant operator. Nothing happens when we differentiate it with respect to space or time. So if this is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then that is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And two of those added together is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So as long as the UK are classical number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, this whole thing is an operator-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So we already have right away the hermeticity conditions and the equations of motion. Then we found out that it's not quite so easy to make sure that the canonical commutation relations hold. In principle, it's easy to derive what extra condition the functions uk will have to obey in order for the canonical commutation relations to hold. All you do is you take phi, write it in this way, and you calculate the canonically conjugate momentum field pi in this way from this ansatz. So we have both phi and pi. We know what commutation relations they have to obey. And therefore, we get a condition on what these functions u have to obey in order for the phi and the pi to obey the usual canonical commutation relation. And here in the box is the condition that comes out of this. It's just two or three lines. We did that last time. So expressing phi and pi using this ansatz and requiring the canonical commutation relations to hold gives us this condition on those solutions uk. You see, if all we want is the hermeticity condition and the equation of motion, then things would be very easy. We just take one solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, plug it in here, and we're done. Because the equation of motion will hold, the hermeticity condition will hold. The only reason why we need lots of those solutions here summed up is that this is a rather non-trivial condition to obey. Let's remind ourselves why it is a difficult condition to obey. Okay, so here is square root of the determinant, the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric, and there's the metric. And then here we have those solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation popping up and their complex conjugates and their derivatives. If we didn't sum over several solutions, but just took one, or let's say 25 of them, just a finite number of those solutions here, if this sum were a finite sum, this equation could never hold because the solutions uk are well-behaved. The Klein-Gödel equation is a well-behaved differential equation. So are its solutions. And so are its derivatives. So here we just have the product of mode functions. These guys are called mode functions. Mode functions and their derivatives and complex conjugates and their differences and multiplied with a metric, all right, and this thing summed up. If this is just a finite number of terms, the whole thing here on the left-hand side is some well-behaved function of space and time. What we do want is not a well-behaved function of space and time. No, we want this, which is not dependent on time and not dependent in a nice way on space, because it's a Dirac delta in space. Clearly, if this is a finite sum, left-hand side cannot be that thing on the right-hand side. And of course, we know from Minkowski space, where we have already the solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, that indeed we have to take infinitely many of those k's, all of the momenta, right? So you have to sum over all of the momenta, and then indeed we do get that, and I will later show you the calculation that verifies this. At the end of the last lecture, we skipped the proof, but let me give you the gist of it. I hope you all read it during reading week. So what the proof is showing is that indeed on a globally hyperbolic space-time, no closed time-like curves, there indeed always exists a set of solutions, uk, such that this condition is obeyed. It's actually always possible. And for that purpose, we use the so-called Dabu theorem, which is a theorem about symplectic forms. It turns out that this thing suggests a symplectic form. We will get to this a little later again. You can apply the Dabu theorem. It's similar to diagonalizing a self-adjoint operator. And then we obtain that this can always be fulfilled. That way of looking at things shows that this is essentially a resolution of the identity in Hilbert space. This is the identity operator as a kernel. If you multiply that with a function and integrate over, you get the function again, right? It's a resolution of the identity. So this whole thing on the left is a resolution of the identity. Now, so what we showed is that the canonical commutation relations can be obeyed at all time. At least if we choose a fixed coordinate system, right? So we chose a fixed coordinate system, and then we found that this is the condition that needs to be obeyed in order to have the canonical commutation relations hold. And then we used Dabu's theorem to prove that there always exists at least one solution, which means one set of number-valued functions uk, which are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that this equation holds. So that's fine. On one hand, that tells us the canonical commutation relations can be obeyed, in fact, for all time. Let me make a remark. If the canonical commutation relations were not obeyed at all time, then that would be bad news. It would mean that we break the framework of quantum theory, because as long as Hamiltonians are self-adjoint, they generate a unitary time evolution. And a unitary time evolution always preserves the canonical commutation relations. That's automatic. It doesn't matter what theory we are dealing with. Unitary time evolution preserves the canonical commutation relations. And therefore, vice versa, if the canonical commutation relations are not preserved, the evolution could not be unitary. So in practice, consider some quantum theory. Doesn't have to be quantum field theory. Could even be first quantization. Then consider the time evolution operator. Remember, the time evolution operator from time t0 to time t can always be written as a time order product of the exponentiated Hamiltonian. If you're not familiar with this, just consider the special case where the Hamiltonian does not depend on time. If the Hamiltonian does not depend on time, then we can simply integrate this out, and this is simply e to the power of I time interval times the Hamiltonian, and we don't need the time evolution the time ordering operator in here. Main point is the time evolution operator is always unitary. So with the unitary time evolution operator, now in the case of quantum field theory, we can express the fields at a later time in terms of the fields at an earlier time. It applies to phi, it applies to pi, it applies to every observable. We can evolve it in time by putting the time evolution operator to the left and its adjoint to the right. And so we get the field at a later time in terms of the field at an earlier time. What does that mean for the commutation relations now? Let us consider the commutation relations between the field and its canonically conjugate momentum field at a time t, which is a later time, and use the time evolution operators to express those late time fields in terms of the early time fields. So this is u phi at the earlier time t naught, and here we have the adjoint or inverse of the time evolution operator on the right-hand side. Remember, u is unitary, so it doesn't matter whether we take the adjoint or the inverse. Okay, so we have that both for phi and pi. Both need to be time evolved. Then, you see, when you write out what the commutator is, you see that you get one term, which is this times that, in which case this inverse unitary will eat up that unitary. And then there is also a term where this is on the left-hand side and that one is on the right-hand side. Again, we have a U inverse colliding with a U, which is then eaten up. So overall, we can actually see here that the commutator of the time-evolved operators is the time evolution of the commutator. But the commutator between phi and pi at an early time, is given by the Dirac delta. So let's put that in. And then we have here the time evolution operator, Dirac delta, which is trivial as an operator on Hilbert space, and then the inverse of the time evolution operator. So this eats up that, and we're left with this. So we find that the commutation relations at the late time are the same as those at an earlier time. And that would apply not only to phi and pi, but also any function of phi or pi. Commutation relations are always obeyed. Unitary transformations are the canonical transformations, are the analog of canonical transformations in classical mechanics. If you remember, in classical mechanics, there are canonical transformations. They are the ones that preserve the Poisson bracket. In quantum mechanics, the canonical transformations are the ones that preserve the commutation relations, and they are the unitaries. There's one thing we have to clean up still. Namely, what if we had chosen a different coordinate system to work in? If we choose a different coordinate system, then we are having a different, then we are implying a different slicing of space-time into a stack of space-like hypersurfaces, or into a so-called foliation into space-like hypersurfaces. Now, that's the whole reason for why relativity is called relativity, because equal time is relative. So choosing a different coordinate system, we get a different slicing into equal time surfaces, three-dimensional, of course, and we get a different slicing of space-time, of four-dimensional space-time into three-dimensional space-like hypersurfaces. And so if we take a different coordinate system, then we are imposing our quantization on a different surface. Do we get a different theory in this way? Or do we get the same one? So here's a proposition. If the canonical commutation relations hold in one coordinate system, then they hold in all. The canonical commutation relations keep holding when we are deforming the space-like hypersurface on which we are imposing the canonical commutation relation. How can we show that? Well, remember this expression here. To ensure that the canonical commutation relations between phi and pi hold for this ansatz, in order to ensure that the canonical commutation relations hold for phi and pi, this condition must be obeyed by those mode functions u. And you see this expression here, where you have mode function and then spatial derivative of the complex conjugate, etc., minus the other way around. That's a symplectic form. If you plug in here a mode function, and here some other mode functions, complex conjugate, then you get out some function, and you get out some number if you integrate this out. And it's symplectic because if you change the two arguments, then you get a minus sign, because this term becomes that one, and that term becomes this one. I have to refer here to the proof that we skipped at the end of the last lecture, that was assigned reading. But the main point is that the condition that needed to be obeyed had this expression in it, a special case actually of it, right? Where you had here the u and the v star, and here you had the v and the u star, right? I hope you recognize that this is from that over here. So what we need to show is the following, namely that our condition for this resolution of the identity, the condition for the canonical commutation relations to hold, was a condition that involved that expression. And what we want to show is that that expression gives us the same value no matter on what space-like hypersurface we evaluate it. So imagine space-time, and let's say time runs in this way, and space runs upwards. Let's say we have a coordinate system for which all those events here are at equal time. In particular, those two events, let's say, are at equal time. Okay? So we have a slicing of space-time into where we have this slicing here for space-like hypersurface. But we may modify that. We may choose a different coordinate system. And in a different coordinate system, starting here, we get that all those points are having equal time. What if we did our quantization for that slicing of space-time? And of course, the same argument could be done at everywhere, right? But in particular, we take one slicing and then we change it a little bit, bulge it out a little bit. All this is space-like separated to each other. So it's just as well to say that these guys are all equal time as to say that those guys are all equal time. Let us analyze the integrand. So the integrand in this expression here is this thing here. And we recognize from the index structure that it is a contravariant vector field. We need to integrate that over a space-like hypersurface, sigma. How can we integrate that? Well, we have to reinterpret the contravariant vector field as the 3 form. For those of you who have been in my course last term, this should be familiar. How do we get a 3 form from a contravariant vector field? Well, we take the volume form and we plug in the vector field. The volume form is a 4 form in space-time. We plug in that vector field with the inner derivation, and we're left with a 3 form. And 3 forms can be integrated over 3-dimensional submanifolds. Remember that only P forms can be integrated over p-dimensional submanifolds. So we obtain that more complicated expression up there, this one, which arose from the condition of preservation of the canonical commutation relations, can be written in this way. And now let's integrate over both, over this space-like hypersurface and that space-like hypersurface, and then there's some volume in between. And this we can choose very far out if we want to. And we can use Stokes' theorem then, which says that integrating over the boundary of B is giving us the same value as if we integrated the exterior derivative of that J form over the entire volume there. So if we can show that that exterior derivative of J is actually vanishing, then the right-hand side is vanishing. And we therefore have that the integral of J over the entire boundary, which is really both of those space-like hypersurfaces, is zero. And if we achieve that, we are done. See, because then we have that the integral over the entire boundary, let me just put up the picture again. So if we integrate over that entire boundary over there, then we get zero. Then this is an integral really over this and an integral over that. And the sum of the two will be zero. There's something subtle though. See, the integral over that entire boundary of B, the early space-like hypersurface and the later one, this can be written as the integral over the early space-like hypersurface plus the integral over the late space-like hypersurface. But you see the way that Stokes' theorem works. The integrals are such that the J is always pointing out of that region B here, always like this, and here out like that. If you reverse that, where are we? Here. If we make both future pointing, then you see, this one is pointing towards the past because this is the time direction, past. If we make that future pointing, then it reverses the sign of the integral. And we obtain that 0 is equal to that first integral over the first space-like hypersurface plus the integral over the other space-like hypersurface. And so now we see that 0 is equal to minus this plus that. The two integrals are really the same. And that is what we wanted to show. We wanted to show that whether we integrate over this space-like hypersurface or that, we get the same outcome, and therefore the same quantization condition. However, in order to be able to draw that conclusion, we still have to show that indeed the integral over the total thing here is zero, and we want to show that by showing that on the right-hand side we have a zero, the integral over the entire bulk here. And our aim is to show that by proving that the d of j is vanishing. Okay, so a little bit more technical stuff, and I don't know how familiar you are with these things. Those who took my course last term are probably very familiar with it. But for the others, I would say, you know, if you have any further, if you have questions about this, see me later. I can point you to the right references or explain it on the spot. So for the moment, let me just pretend you all know the necessary mathematical background there. We won't need this later for applications in cosmology. But it's important to have seen this happen so that you have a feeling for what is underlying the whole framework. Okay, so we calculate d j tilde. We want to show that this is vanishing. Remember that j is a contravariant vector. J tilde is a 3-form obtained by taking the 4-form, that is the volume form, and plugging in using the inner derivation, the contravariant vector as the first argument. So that whole thing is a 3-form. The d of it will be a 4-form. And in fact, it's the divergence of the j vector with respect to that volume form. And the divergence can be written in this way, where this is derivative with respect to x mu. Let's work out what this actually is. So we have square root of g, j mu, and then differentiate in the x mu direction and summed over mu. Let's plug in what j is. J was that, right? Sorry. Yeah, it's this. J was that expression here. We have to differentiate that. Differentiate that with respect to x mu. Now there's products of four terms here, but we'll not work out the product rule completely. We will just use the product rule once. So let's consider this term, for example. We have to differentiate that term with respect to x mu. We will write this as the sum of two terms. One term where we leave these two terms undifferentiated, leave that undifferentiated, and differentiate this. Plus, by the product rule, there will be a term where we leave that undifferentiated, and the product of the three remaining terms gets differentiated. Okay? So the first term we have here. Everything is the same from here to here. Everything is just carried forward. The d nu, g is carried forward, the metric, the square root of g, all just carried forward, except the f is being differentiated. It's over here. Okay? That's one term of the product rule here. And then there's this other term that I promised, where we are not differentiating the f, but we're differentiating everything else. That's this one. So we are not differentiating f, but everything else gets differentiated in the x mu direction. That's that second term. And here, same deal, we get two terms. Now it turns out that this term matches exactly that one. And so, but with a minus sign, so those two terms drop out. On the other hand, this term we recognize as arising in the Klein-Gordon equation. Klein-Gordon equation is over here. And we have that the D'Alembert operator plus m squared phi is equal to 0. And this gives us the D'Alembert operator. And just putting that m squared phi on the right-hand side, we see that we can replace all occurrences of this by occurrences of the mass term. So we have here that this is f times minus m squared g squared of g. And the same over here, except that they come up with opposite signs, so that really we have two terms that are the same but arising with opposite signs, and overall this is vanishing. Okay, so we finally shown that with the help of Stokes' theorem and Darboux's theorem, that it is always possible, and at least on globally hyperbolic space-time, to find number-valued solutions uk of x and t, such that the answers above for the Klein-Gordon field succeed, and in particular that this resolution of the identity equation is obeyed at all times and in all coordinate systems. Let's make it concrete. In Minkowski space, how does all of that stuff look like? So in Minkowski space, we had found this solution for the Klein-Gordon field. Let me remind you, our ansatz was, where is it? There it is. Okay, so here's the ansatz in general, general curved space-time. These are number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and then here A and A Dagger operators. So this complex or Hermitian conjugated gives us that, right? So the ansatz is really A operator times classical solution plus Hermitian conjugate. On Minkowski space, we already found that the solution has this shape, has this form. Namely, here we go. Phi of x and t is given by not a sum over k, but an integral over k. If we put the system in a big box, then it will be sum over k. It's a sum over k, or integral over k. And then some function times a plus the Hermitian conjugate times a dagger of k. Right? So this is this times that is the mode function uk for Minkowski space. And then this times all of this is the mode function uk star, just a complex conjugate of it. So you recognize that this is of the general shape of the ansatz that we discussed above. With the mode function, with the mode functions uk taking this form, it's this prefactor, that prefactor, and all of this stuff in here. Right? Notice that this is the complex conjugate of that, as it should be. So let's verify that indeed the canonical commutation relations condition, namely this resolution of the identity condition, holds. So in the case of Minkowski space, things simplify, of course. The square root of g is just 1, and the metric is just the eta of Minkowski space, and in particular g 0 nu, which arises in a canonically conjugate momentum field, is just the Kronecker delta of 0 and nu. And therefore, the left-hand side of our resolution of the identity equation, you know, the equation that needed to be fulfilled for the canonical commutation relations to be fulfilled, the left-hand side looks like this, where we have the mode function and then the time derivative time derivative of the complex conjugate of the mode function minus and then just flipped around. That's because the canonically conjugate momentum field in the case of Minkowski space, it's just the time derivative of phi. That's why we simply have the time derivative. In general, it's more complicated. So now, let us spell out what it is in the case of Minkowski space. We plug in what the mode functions are, and we get all of this. And then we collect the terms together, and we find that it is this expression here, And now we see that indeed, when we integrate over k, and first of all, those omega k factors cancel out, but also when we integrate over k, then even though each one of the individual terms is a well-behaved function, in this case a plane wave, the integral over all of them is capable of producing the Dirac delta. But we had to integrate over all of them. So in this way, the I times the Dirac delta does arise, and that's what we needed. We needed that the resolution of the identity equation came out. Notice that on the right-hand side, there's no more time dependent. Left-hand side seems to have one, but it completely drops out. Okay, so let me summarize what we have so far. To solve the quantum field theory of a free Klein-Gordon field on a curved space-time means that we have to solve the hermeticity condition, the equation of motion, and the canonical commutation relation. Here is the answer that always works, at least in reasonable cases, like no travel back in time and so on, for hyperbolic space-times. This answer could involve an integral or a sum, depending, let's say, on whether we have a finite box or space-time is considered infinite, in which case there would be an integral. We showed that if space-time is globally hyperbolic, then there exists a solution, and there exists a set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, number-valued solutions and complex number-valued solutions. Right? That's perhaps important. In Minkowski space, these things are complex number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, even though the theory that we are quantizing is the theory of a real-valued Klein-Gordon field. Right? Nevertheless, these things had to come out complex-valued, because these are the mode functions, not classical solutions. So our conclusion so far is that for globally hyperbolic space-times, there always exists such a set of classical solutions, of number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, complex-valued ones, such that this answer A solves all of the conditions, hermeticity condition, equation of motion, and the canonical commutation relations at all time and in all coordinate systems. It would seem that's good, fine. Figured it out, even coordinate system independently. And yet there is still, still something we have to worry about, which is, well, there may be one solution, but maybe there are many. Maybe there are a dozen solutions, or a million, or infinitely many. Then in that case, how do we pick? What's the right solution? Well, it turns out, so the big question is, does there exist only one such set of solutions, one such set of mode functions, UK? And once we have found that glorious set of mode functions, we are done, and the theory is solved. Well, the answer is no. There exist many other such sets of solutions. And let's indicate them with bars. So let's say there's another set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, which allow us to obey all conditions of the quantization, might be called the set of solutions U bar K, or U double bar K. It's easy to show on generic grounds that there is this non-uniqueness, that we can generate many solutions. Remember the symplectic form for two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So if V is the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, F and G are both elements of that space, so F and G are both solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then the symplectic form on that vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation was this one. That was a central piece of the proof of the end of the last lecture. So we consider the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. It's a vector space because it's a linear equation, the Klein-Gordon equation. If you have two solutions, the sum of the two is also a solution, right? And five times a solution is also a solution. So the solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation form a vector space, and that vector space has on it a symplectic form. You plug in two solutions and you get out a number in this way. Plug the solutions in, pick a space-like hypersurface, integrate over, get a number. And as we just showed earlier today, it doesn't matter which space-like hypersurface you choose. Then the Dabo theorem showed that there exists a basis in that space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, a basis Vn of solutions, such that in that basis, this symplectic form takes this matrix representation. Now, it is symplectic, remember, it's symplectic. It's not a Hermitian form. Hermitian form would mean that it's always a real outcome. It's always a real number that we get. Here we don't. And also, if we choose, if we interchange f and g, we pick up a minus sign. Okay, that wouldn't be the case for a symmetric form. So the Dabo theorem says that whenever we are looking at a symplectic form like that, then there is a basis in which the symplectic form has this simple matrix representation. So it's block diagonal, with each block looking like this, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And the rest, everything that's further away from the diagonal is 0. We can complexify that, and that was part of the proof. We can complexify that. We can look at a new basis of a complexified vector space V, where we take not just the real solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation, but also any complex linear combinations of them. Then a basis of that complex vector space can be given in this way. You can choose the un solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation, which are obtained by taking the solution v2n plus I times the solution v2n plus 1. Yeah, this should be familiar to you if you've read the proof, right? Okay. Now, the thing about the Dabo basis is that unlike the diagonalization of a Hermitian form, which is unique, that's not the case for the diagonalization, according to Dabo's theorem, of symplectic forms. Dabo bases are not unique. Let's take the very simplest case. Let's say we pick just a two-dimensional solution subspace. So V1 and V2 are solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation, and the symplectic form on that two-dimensional space is just this. It's one of those boxes up there, right? So there's one of those boxes, another one of those boxes. Let's just look at a two-dimensional subspace like that. Then let's ask, can we change bases from the basis of the V1 and the V2 of that two-dimensional space of solutions to a new basis of vectors of solution functions V bar, which are related to the V by some matrix, by some 2x2 matrix, such that for these new basis vectors, the representation of the symplectic form is still the same? So we are asking whether we can change bases with matrices B such that in the new basis, this matrix takes the same shape as before. Well, you can calculate that. Just plug in an arbitrary matrix B with matrix elements A, B, C, D, and then you will find that yes, this matrix goes into that matrix if that condition is obeyed. It's a little exercise for you. So clearly, the Dabo bases are not unique. But that means that there is in principle an infinite variety of solutions to our problem. The problem being solving the hermeticity condition, equations of motion, and canonical commutation relations. In principle, we can write our quantum field, the function of space and time, operator valued function space of time, in this way, with mode functions uk, suitably chosen, but those mode functions are not unique. We could also write down a solution like this. We could also write down our solution like this with another mode function here, another set of mode functions, or yet another set of mode functions, all of which obey all the conditions to get this, this, and that. So what should we do? Is there a preferred choice? At this point, let me remind you of the harmonic oscillator study that we did at the very beginning. Remember that we had the driven harmonic oscillator. And at early times, we had A and A dagger operators, A in and A in dagger operators. We used them to build a Fock space. And at late times, we had A and A dagger operators, and they were different. Okay? This should ring a bell. We'll soon see how this links up with that. See, we can write down the same solution, as we will soon see, the same quantum field solution. We can write it down using mode functions u with operators a and a dagger, or same thing, where we have different mode functions, and in order to get the same phi, we have different a and a dagger operators. So we put a bar over the a and a dagger as well. Or in this case, two bars over the A and the A daggers. And in particular, once we've made a choice, let's say we write our solution using this ansatz here with a particular set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Once we've made that choice, it comes with a Fock basis of the Hilbert space. The Fock basis that is generated by this operator A. We have A act on a vector 0 and annihilate it. And then we apply A dagger multiple times on that vector to generate an orthonormal basis, a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. Okay, so we get a basis of the Hilbert space employing those A and A dagger operators. In another occasion, perhaps for the same problem but a different time, we may want to see our field phi expressed in this way, where this is a different bunch of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And these are different A and A dagger operators with bars over them. And they too come with a representation, and they too come with a choice of a basis in the Hilbert space. Namely, there will be some vector in the Hilbert space that's annihilated by A bar, like this. And then there will be vectors generated by applying the A bar dagger operators on our vector 0 bar. Sorry. Okay. So we will find that sometimes it is convenient to write our quantum field using one set of mode functions and the corresponding set of A and A daggers, which generate a corresponding basis in the Hilbert space. And at some other time, it may be convenient to write our field in terms of some other mode functions, other A and A dagger operators, which will conveniently generate a different basis in the Hilbert space. Just like in the case of the driven harmonic oscillator, the in and the out cases had their own convenient Fock bases. But it could be, in principle, that we get different physics here, right? It could be that maybe if we choose some weird solutions over there that still obey all the conditions, we actually get a physically different phi than the phi up over here, for example. Is that possible? Could it be that different solutions of the quantum field theory actually describe different physics? Or do they differ only by a mere change of bases, as I made it sound like it being the case? In principle, it depends. In practice, the answer is that it is unique, but in principle, it depends. Let me explain you how that comes about. Let us first assume that we can impose infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs on our theory. Remember, ultraviolet cutoff means we are cutting off the high momentum. We are not integrating over all momentum. Let us also impose an infrared cutoff, which means that we put our system into a box. The implication of this is the following. Putting the system into a box means that the momenta become discretized. And on curved space, there's an analog of momenta. In any case, the set of the mode functions can be discretized in this way by putting the system in a huge box or confining the system into a huge box. And then imposing an ultraviolet cutoff means that those discrete momenta cannot grow arbitrarily large. And the upshot of all of this is that there are only going to be a finite number of those momenta. And only a finite number of those mode functions. So we are only going to have a finite number of independent mode oscillators. There's only going to be, for the A and A daggers, the index N is going to run only through a finite index set. Yes?
But if we only have a finite number of mode functions, is the equation we use to prove the existence?
Yes, you are right. That's a subtle point. It happens actually a little earlier already. In order to have a Dirac delta over here, we need to integrate over all momenta. Otherwise, if we don't integrate over all momenta, then this integral over the plane waves doesn't give us a Dirac delta. It gives us instead a sinc function. A sinc function is an approximation to the Dirac delta, but it's not quite a Dirac delta. So yes, if you impose an ultraviolet cutoff, then you're actually changing the theory. You're changing it by saying that, you know, commutation relations are going to be affected. Clearly, the Dirac delta requires arbitrarily small wavelengths. If we don't allow arbitrarily small wavelengths, we can't have a Dirac delta. So we're changing the theory there. But of course, the idea is to change it only in the far ultraviolet, like 10 orders of magnitude below what an accelerator can probe. So yes, an ultraviolet cutoff will change the theory by saying that the short distances, it's different. Hopefully in such a way that either it corresponds to what nature really does, or the cutoff is removable, so that we temporarily impose that cutoff, and then at the end of the calculations, we let the cutoff go away again, so that we recover the original theory. And also, the infrared cutoff changes the theory. If we are living in an infinite universe, and we put an infrared cutoff, in principle, we are saying, no, it's not infinite. It's confined. Okay, so I'm just saying that if we are imposing infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, at least temporarily, then we have the benefit of having only a finite number of degrees of freedom. We have only a finite number of mode functions and only a finite number of A operators. Then the following theorem by Stone and von Neumann applies. Assume that in a Hilbert space, there are operators x and p, which obey the usual canonical commutation relations, where the I and j run through some finite index set. Then assume that in that same Hilbert space, there are other operators, x tildes and p tildes, which also obey the same canonical commutation relations. Then we know from a discussion we had earlier that this means that there may be a unitary transformation that gets us from those x and p's to these x tildes and p tildes, there may be a unitary transformation because the canonical commutation relations are being preserved, right? Remember, unitary transformations preserve the canonical commutation relations. Now, Stone and von Neumann go further and they say, yes, not only can there be, there is a unitary transformation from these x and p's to those x tildes and p tildes, which is to say that these x and p operators are identical to those x tildes and p tildes p tilde operators up to a choice of basis. Because a unitary transformation can always be viewed as just a change of basis. Now, there are some caveats here. We had to assume that there's only a finite number of degrees of freedom. That's why I was asking for the infrared and ultraviolet cutoff earlier. And another is that really, this is not exactly what Stone and von Neumann are promising. And the reason is that it's a technical one. You don't need to worry too much about it, but you should be aware of it. The x and p operators of quantum mechanics, or in our case, this will be, of course, the phi and pi operators of quantum field. The canonically conjugate operators that obey these commutation relations, be they fields, first or second quantization, doesn't matter. If they obey these commutation relations, then it is implied, it's automatic, that these operators must be unbounded operators. At least one of them has to be an unbounded operator. You can easily see that. Just take the trace of the left-hand side and the right-hand side under the assumption that these are, let's say, finite-dimensional matrices. If they were finite-dimensional matrices, the trace of the left-hand side would vanish. Trace of the right-hand side would be I times the dimension of the space. So, for I equal to j. So, certainly they have to be operators, but it turns out they also have to be unbounded operators. And unbounded operators, it's just a technical remark, can never be defined on the entire Hilbert space. They can only be defined on a dense subset of that Hilbert space. And that makes it subtle to claim that there is a unitary transformation automatically that maps these unbounded operators into those unbounded operators. There are pathological exceptions, of which no physical meaning is known. What Stone and von Neumann really showed is the following. They looked at not x and p, but their exponentiated versions. So they exponentiated the p operator, e to the power of I alpha p, and that is, of course, a finite translation operator. And they exponentiated the x. And in this way, they obtain two unitary operators. The commutation relations between x and p then translate into commutation relations for those unitary operators. And what they showed is that there is always a unitary change of basis that gets us from the commutation relations of those exponentiated x and p operators to those exponentiated x and p operators down there. That's much easier to show because unitary operators are bounded operators, and they live on the entire Hilbert space. There's more control over this thing. But still, just a sec. So the take-home message is that for all practical purposes, there is a unitary transformation that gets us from the untilded x to the tilded x's, and from the untilded p's to the tilded p's, or from the phi to another phi, from the pi to another pi. If they obey the same canonical commutation relations, they are related by a change of basis. This is a remark I already made about exponentiating the x and the p and then working with those unitaries and their commutation relations and then showing that their commutation relations are really uniquely represented up to a choice of basis. Now, in quantum field theory, we can look at the operators that we obtain when we take creation and annihilation operators, basically the fields up to some time dependence that doesn't matter. And then we obtain that whether we write our fields in terms of A and A dagger operators or A bar and A bar dagger operators doesn't matter, just the choice of basis, it's the same physics. So the unbarred operators and the barred operators are related by some unitary. Still, I don't want to sweep everything just under the rug. There is one occasion when it seems to matter that we cannot really truncate to a finite number of degrees of freedom. And that is the case of so-called phase transition. Technically, in statistical physics, when you are looking at systems that undergo phase transitions, you always need, for the actual discontinuity to happen when a phase changes, you actually need that the system has infinitely many degrees of freedom. And it turns out that when you do the quantum theory of that, you can evade the Stone-Forman theorem. And it's not so hard to see how, when you have a system of infinitely many parts, unitary equivalence that you would have of finitely many parts fails. Here's how it goes. Let's say you have you have a system, and there are two states in it. One state we call A, and another pure state is B. And let's say that the two states are not orthogonal to each other. So the overlap between A and B is alpha, which is some number. It could be a complex number, but let's just assume it's some real number between 0 and 1 to keep things simple. So A and B are not the same state, but they're also not orthogonal. So in particular, A will have some component of B in it, right? If this is not 0, A will have some component of B in it, which means that you can use A to help linearly combine a vector that needs a component of B in it. You can do that. Now, let's see what happens when we take many copies of that same system. So let's say we take many copies of that same system, then we have, in particular, a state of this multi-party system now. We have a state which is of the form A, 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 A. It's really A tensor A tensor A tensor A, right? And let's look at what the inner product is, what the overlap is of that state with the state where the whole collection is now B's. So it's B tensor B tensor B tensor B. Clearly, this goes all, you know, partwise, and overall, the overlap is alpha to the power capital N if our new total system consists of N individual parts, each of which realizes this. So the overlap between that tensor product state and then that tensor product state is alpha to the power N, which is way smaller than alpha, because alpha is smaller than 1. And yet, they're not orthogonal. So you can, in principle, you can say that this vector has some component of that vector in it. You can use it, for example, to linearly combine some vector that needs some B component in it. But as you let N go to infinity, an infinitely large system now, in that case, you can write down what that vector would be, or this vector would be, but the overlap now becomes 0, strictly 0. And suddenly things change, because suddenly you have orthogonality where you didn't have it before. So you could not now use the vector with lots of with all of A's, with only A's, to help linearly combine a vector that has the B's in it. So in situations where we have phase transitions, we should expect that it is non-trivial. Quantum fields can be in different phases. But from now on, and for the purpose of the study of quantum fluctuations in cosmology, we will not need this. And you will always assume that, in principle, we can always perform an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, Stone-Forman's theorem applies, and we have uniqueness. So that means that in principle, it doesn't matter which set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation we use in order to get to solve our quantum field theory. We could choose a bunch of solutions, UN, or barred ones, or double barred ones. There's going to be infinitely many of them, and it's completely up to us which we choose. Either way, whatever number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation we choose that obeys all our conditions up there, we are going to get the same solution of our quantum field theoretical problem up to choice of basis. So the A will be used to generate a basis in the Hilbert space, annihilating some vector, and then we apply this to create a basis. And here, the same thing. And we're always describing the same Hilbert space, the same phi, but different bases, different choices of bases in there. And it will be a matter of convenience to choose one set of mode functions one time, another set of mode functions another time. One time we choose this set of mode functions, comes with this convenient basis, and another time we want another convenient basis. So if we choose unbarred ones, for example, then we generate one Hilbert space basis by looking at the vector 0 that is annihilated by the A for all k. We apply a dagger any number of times on that vector, and we generate in this way an orthonormal basis. And we get we get all the basis vectors in this way. Or alternatively, we work with different mode functions. Then we have, if these are the mode functions, then the corresponding A bar operators will annihilate a vector 0 bar. That's a different one. And we generate a different Fock basis. All of this happening in the same Hilbert space, but a different basis. And just like we did earlier with the driven harmonic oscillator, some bases might be convenient early on, another basis might be convenient later. So as we said, the choice of mode functions does not in principle matter. We could just make one choice and stick with it for the time evolution, from early to middle to late, doesn't matter. We can describe the whole system, we can describe everything about the quantum field theory. Just a matter of convenience. And how does convenience come into this? Well, for example, we may model the early universe. We may want to model the universe as being devoid of particles at a certain point in time. We may say, okay, as inflation starts, as the universe is about to expand dramatically, it may be empty of particles. But as an assumption, we put that in there. Then what we are saying thereby is that the quantum field was in its vacuum state at that point in time. So it is therefore useful to choose mode functions, UK, such that are designed in such a way that they not only obey all the conditions above, but also that the corresponding vector 0 that they generate, and by that I mean the UK mode functions come with creation annihilation operators A and A dagger, and the vector 0 that's annihilated by the A's ought to be the one in which the quantum field is in. That would be convenient. Right? So if we know that at a particular point in time the universe was devoid of particles, then it would be really convenient to know what basis, what set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation we should choose, such that the corresponding annihilation operators single out a vector that they annihilate, which happens to be the null particle vector at that time. And we will have to find out how to do that. And then if we then think, well, maybe there were a few particles, we can always write down the state with the presence of some particles by just applying the A-Dagger operator a few times on that. So here's a rough outlook of how this will then play out. Let's say we know that the system is in a state that we may call psi initially, and let's say it's the vacuum state initially. We will choose solutions appropriately such that the zero vector of the Fock basis construction comes out to be that state that the system is in initially. Now, we are going to work in the Heisenberg picture. So this is going to be the state for all time, no matter what happens dynamically, just because in the Heisenberg picture, the state is always the same. But after some evolution, the vector that describes the vacuum may not be the same Hilbert space vector anymore. Now, at a later time, there may be a vector chi that describes the no particle state. This would indicate that particles have been created, because this is the state that the system is in, and at a later time, this is not the state of no particles. So it's got to be a state with the presence of particles. In order to calculate how many particles exactly have been produced at a later time, we can calculate which solutions, or we design that those solutions of the this set of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, now with a bar on top, whose associated A annihilation operators A bar are annihilating a vector which happens to be the vacuum vector at a later time. Okay? So at an earlier time, a particular vector in a Hilbert space is the vacuum vector. At a later time, a particular other state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector. At early time, we can do a Fock construction with a suitable set of basis vectors such that the zero vector of that Fock construction happens to coincide with the vacuum vector at that time. And we can do a Fock construction at the later time with a different set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that the associated annihilation operators A bar will annihilate a vector that happens to be the vacuum vector at a later time. And then we are in a very similar situation to what we had earlier with the driven harmonic oscillator. We can calculate then the map from one Fock basis to the other, and therefore can calculate the number of particles that have been generated, or the density of particles that have been generated. Here's a little exercise, and we'll close with that exercise today. Remember that with respect to the, this is something to do with that proof that we did omit at the end of last lecture. When you take the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equations, the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then you can define a symplectic form, and you can, when you complexify it, as we did earlier, then you can go from the real solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation to the complex solution. By the Darboux theorem, there's always a basis such that those basis vectors will have those overlaps. Un overlap with um is the Kronecker delta. The starred version has a minus sign, and the mixed ones have an overlap of zero. Now imagine we change bases in the space of solutions. Then can we change bases in the space of solutions in such a way that this is preserved? This is just an abstract statement of what we are doing concretely up there. So let's say the un are a basis of complex solutions, and we do a change of basis that maps the u's using this matrix A and the u stars using a matrix B into new solutions, right? I mean, if this is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, that's the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then any linear combination, and that means any matrix here, any matrix there, gives us something which is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. Because any linear combination of solutions is a solution. Then we can ask, what constraints are there on A and B such that these barred guys obey the same thing? Never mind exactly how it comes about, this inner product. I mean, this has to do with this exact way that the symplectic form is generated within the graph. But never mind that, just knowing this and knowing that, you can calculate what the conditions are on A and B such that if the u obey this, the u bars obey it as well. Okay? And it turns out that these are the conditions on A and B, and they come up whenever we change from one Fock basis to another Fock basis in a quantum system. We will have special cases of this occur all the time, and if you do that exercise, you will recognize it. Otherwise, you will just see it arise case by case. All right? So that was the technical background, and from Thursday onwards, we will apply that to actual curved space, and things will be much simpler. Okay? That's it for today.